Well, thanks everyone for coming. I've been going around telling folks, especially the AFSC folks that helped put together a lot of these presentations, most of these, that it's really good timing to be out here and be on this tour talking to a lot of people around New England about what's really happening in Iraq, especially right now that we passed this 2,000 mark. But it feels really a bit off to say it's a great thing to be talking at this time when actually it's very horrible, especially looking at the situation there and that it's not going to slow down anytime soon. What I'm going to talk to you about tonight is I am going to essentially give you the presentation that I gave in Turkey at the World Tribunal on Iraq. I was asked to go there to testify about torture that's going on in Iraq right now, as well as the situation with the healthcare system under occupation, and then give an update on what is the situation on the ground like right now for the Iraqi people and for U.S. soldiers. So I'm going to do that and show photos as I go through my talk, and then I will talk a bit about Fallujah, and I have a film to show you about the second siege of Fallujah tonight as well. But before I get started, I'm going to do something a little bit unorthodox, and I just want you to find someone, ideally not the person that you came here with, and just introduce yourself to them and take a minute or two and just tell them briefly why you came here tonight, what brought you here to hear more about Iraq, especially on this day after we just passed the 2,000 mark. So if you'll do that now, please. I'm going to talk a lot tonight about some of the atrocities going on in Iraq related to things that U.S. soldiers are doing, but I want to preface this talk with mentioning that it's really my belief that in the grand scheme of things, of course, it's Iraqi civilians who are paying the highest price for this misadventure of U.S. foreign policy, but also paying the highest price, of course, are U.S. soldiers who have been sent to Iraq on the basis of what has been evident from before they went in and what is now today more clear than ever, sent based on lies. So, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later. But the talk that I'll give regarding the torture and the security situation on the ground and the situation regarding the hospitals is going to focus quite heavily on things that the U.S. military has done wrong. But at the end of the day, they've been put in a position in a no-win situation, just like in Vietnam. And they are in the middle of a very brutal, ugly guerrilla war, which, as we saw even just the other day with a cement truck bomb that attacked two of the hotels where some of the journalists in Baghdad stay, it's nowhere is safe. They can be attacked anytime, anywhere, from anyone. And it's one of the big reasons why there's so many civilian casualties also. So I just want to preface this talk with that. In May of 2004, I was interviewing a man who had just been released from Abu Ghraib prison. Like so many I interviewed from various U.S. military detention facilities, who had been tortured horrifically, he still managed to maintain his sense of humor. He began laughing when he told me of how U.S. soldiers made him beat other prisoners. He laughed because he told me he had been beaten himself prior to that, and he was so tired that all he could do to beat other detained Iraqis was to lift his arm and let it drop on the other men. Later on in the same interview, when telling me of another story, he laughed and said, "The Americans brought electricity to my ass before they brought it to my house." But this discussion is not about the indomitable spirit of the Iraqi people. About the dignity and strength of Iraqis, we need no testimony. This testimony is about ongoing violations of international law being committed by the occupiers of Iraq on a daily basis in regards to rampant torture, the neglect and impeding of the healthcare sector, and the ongoing failure to allow Iraqis to reconstruct their own infrastructure. To discuss torture, there are so many stories I could use here tonight, but I'll use two examples which are indicative of scores of others I documented while in Iraq. Ali Abbas lives in the Al-Amariya district of Baghdad. So many of his neighbors were detained that friends urged him to go to the nearby U.S. base to try to get answers as to why so many innocent people were being detained. He went three times. On the fourth time, he was detained himself, despite not being charged with any crime. This was on September 13, 2003. Within 2 days, he was transferred from the military base to Abu Ghraib, where he was held for over 3 months. "The minute I got there, the suffering began," said Abbas about his interrogator. "I asked him for water, and he said after the investigation, I would get some. He accused me of so many things and asked me so many questions. Among them, he said that I hated Christians. He was forced to strip naked shortly after arriving and remained that way for most of his stay in the prison. They made us lay on top of each other as if it was sex and beat us with a broom," he said. "In addition to being beaten on their genitals, detainees were also denied water and food for extended periods of time, then were forced to watch as their food was thrown in the trash. Treatment also included having a loaded gun held to his head so that he would not cry out in pain as his hand ties were tightened. My hands were enlarged because there was no blood, because they cuffed them so tight," he told me. "My head was covered with a sack, and they fastened my right hand to a pole with handcuffs. They made me stand on my toes to clip me to it." Abbas said that at one point, two men came, one a foreigner and one a translator. He asked me who I was. I said, "I am a human being." They told me, "We are going to cut your head off and send you to hell. We will take you to Guantanamo." A female soldier told him, "Our aim is to put you in hell so you would tell the truth. These are the orders we have from our superiors to turn your lives into hell." Abbas added, "They shit on us, used dogs against us, used electricity, and starved us." He told me, "Saddam Hussein used to have people like those who tortured us. Why do they put Saddam into trial, but they do not put the Americans to trial?" But unlike Saddam Hussein, the U.S. interrogators also desecrated Islam as part of their humiliation. Sometimes at night, when he would hold his Holy Quran in the hallway for light, he said, "Soldiers would walk by and kick the Holy Quran, and sometimes they would try to piss on it or wipe shit on it." Abbas did not feel this was the work of a few individual soldiers. Quote, "This was organized, it wasn't just individuals, and every one of the troops in Abu Ghraib was responsible for it." According to a Human Rights Watch report released on April 27th of this year, quote, "Abu Ghraib was only the tip of the iceberg. It's now clear that abuse of detainees has happened all over, from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay to a lot of third country dungeons where the U.S. has sent prisoners, and probably quite a few other places we don't even know about." The report adds, "Harsh and coercive interrogation techniques, such as subjecting detainees to painful stress positions and extended sleep deprivation, have been routinely used in detention centers throughout Iraq. The earlier report of Major General Antonio Tacuba found numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses, constituting systematic and illegal abuse of detainees at Abu Ghraib. Another Pentagon report documented 44 allegations of such war crimes also at Abu Ghraib. Amnesty International has also released similar findings recently. Other human rights groups report that U.S. military doctors, nurses, and medics have been complicit in torture and other illegal procedures, such as those administered to Sadiq Zoman. 55-year-old Zoman, detained from his home in Kirkuk in a raid by U.S. soldiers that produced no weapons, was taken to a police office in Kirkuk, the Kirkuk Airport Detention Center, the Tikrit Airport Detention Center, and then to the U.S. 28th Combat Support Hospital, where he was treated by a Dr. Michael Hodges, a lieutenant colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Hodges' medical report listed the primary diagnosis of Zoman's condition when he was dropped off at the hospital as hypoxic brain injury with persistent vegetative state, myocardial infarction, heart attack, and heat stroke. After 1 month in custody, Zoman was dropped off in a coma at the General Hospital in Tikrit by U.S. soldiers. Zoman's last name was listed as his first name on the report, despite the fact that all of Zoman's identification papers were also taken during the raid on his home. Because of this, it took his family weeks to locate him in the hospital. Hodges' medical report did not mention the fact that the back of Zoman's head was bashed in, nor that he had electrical burn marks on the bottoms of his feet and genitals, or why he had lash marks across his back and his chest. Today he lies in bed still in a coma, and there has been no compensation provided to his now impoverished family for what was done to Sadiq Zoman. Another aspect I shall discuss is the catastrophic situation of the health system in Iraq now. Although the Iraq Ministry of Health has supposedly gained its sovereignty and has received promises of over $1 billion of U.S. funding, hospitals in Iraq continue to face ongoing medicine, equipment, and staffing shortages under the occupation. During the 1990s, medical supplies and equipment were constantly in short supply because of the sanctions against Iraq. While the war and occupation brought promises of relief from the sanctions, hospitals have had little chance to recover and resupply. Instead, the occupation has closely resembled a low-grade war since its inception. In addition, allocation of resources by occupation authorities has been dismal. Thus, throughout Baghdad, there are ongoing shortages of functional equipment and medicines of even the most basic items, such as analgesics, antibiotics, anesthetics, and insulin. Surgical items, and even basic supplies like rubber gloves, gauze, and medical tape are running out. In April of 2004, an International Committee for the Red Cross report stated that hospitals in Iraq are overwhelmed with new patients, short of medicine and supplies, and lack both adequate electricity and water, with ongoing bloodshed stretching the hospital's already meager resources to the limit. Ample testimony from medical practitioners confirms this crisis. A general practitioner at the prosthetics workshop at Al-Kina Hospital in Baghdad, Dr. Thamiz Aziz Abdul Rahman, said, 11 months ago we submitted an emergency order for prosthetic materials to the Ministry of Health, and still we have nothing. After a pause, he added, this is worse than even during the sanctions. Dr. Qasim al-Nuwaisri, the chief manager at Shuadar General Hospital, one of two hospitals in the sprawling slum area of Sadr City, Baghdad, at home to 3 million people, added that they too suffered from a shortage of most supplies. But for his hospital, the lack of potable water was the major problem. Of course, we have typhoid, cholera, kidney stones, but we now even have the very rare hepatitis type E, and it has become common in our area, said al-Nuwaisri, while adding that they never faced these problems prior to the invasion of 2003. Chuadar Hospital needs at least 2,000 liters of water per day to function with basic sterilization practices. According to Dr. Al-Nuwaisri, they receive 15% of this amount. Quote, the rest of the water is contaminated and causing problems, as are the electricity cuts. Without electricity, our instruments in the operating room cannot work, and we have no pumps to bring us water. At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Ahmed, who asked that only his first name be used because he feared U.S. military reprisals, said of the April 2004 siege that, quote, the Americans shot out the lights in the front of our hospital. They prevented doctors from reaching the emergency unit at the hospital, and we quickly began to run out of supplies and much-needed medications. He also said that several times Marines kept the physicians in the residence building, intentionally prohibiting them from entering the hospital in order to treat patients. In November, shortly after razing Nizal Emergency Hospital to the ground, U.S. forces entered Fallujah General Hospital, the city's only healthcare facility for trauma victims, detaining employees and patients alike. According to medics on the scene, water and electricity were cut off, ambulances targeted or confiscated by the U.S. military, and surgeons, without exception, kept out of the besieged city. Hospital raids by the U.S. military and U.S.-backed Iraqi forces now appear to be standard operating procedure. On the 18th of June of this year, doctors at the main hospital in Bakuba went on strike, saying they were fed up with the constant abuse at the hands of aggressive Iraqi police and soldiers. Dr. Mohammed Hazem in Bakuba pleaded for his governor to protect he and his colleagues from what he called organized terrorism of the police and army. When wounded Iraqi security forces showed up demanding treatment, a Dr. Hussein told one of them he would require an x-ray. The doctor was told to go to hell by the policeman he was treating and was then beaten. The same policeman then ordered other Iraqi police officers to put a bag over the doctor's head and take him away. Our security guards tried to stop them, telling them I was a doctor, but they didn't listen and beat the security guards too, he said. Then one of them put a gun to my head and threatened me. Similar behavior has been reported during the recent U.S.-Iraqi military operations in Haditha and Al-Qaim. Doctors also recently went on strike at the large Yarmouk Hospital in Baghdad in a very similar situation. Many doctors in Iraq believe that the lack of assistance, if not outright hostility, by the U.S. military, coupled with the lack of rebuilding and reconstruction by foreign contractors has compounded the problems they are facing. The former ambassador of Iraq, Paul Bremer, admitted that the U.S.-led coalition spending on the Iraq health system was inadequate. Quote, "It's not nearly enough to cover the needs in the healthcare field." When asked if his hospital had received assistance from the U.S. military or reconstruction contractors, Dr. Sarmad Rahim, the administrator of chief doctors at Al-Kirk Hospital in Baghdad, said, "Never, ever. Some soldiers came here 5 months ago and asked what we needed. We told them, and they never brought us one single needle. We heard that some people from the CPA came here, but they never did anything for us." At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Muhammad said there's been virtually no assistance from foreign contractors. And of the U.S. military, he commented, "They send only bombs, not medicine." International aid has been stymied by the horrendous security situation in Iraq. After the UN headquarters was bombed in Baghdad in August of 2003, killing 22 people, aid agencies and NGOs either reduced their staffing or pulled out entirely. With senior Iraqi doctors fleeing Iraq en masse for fear of being kidnapped, interns and younger doctors are left to deal with the catastrophic situation. The World Health Organization last year warned of a health emergency in Baghdad, as well as throughout Iraq, if current conditions persist. But despite claims from the Ministry of Health of more drugs, better equipment, and generalized improvement, doctors on the ground still see, quote, "no such improvement." In conclusion, a summary of the overall situation on the ground in Iraq is now in order. Over 2.5 years into the occupation, while Iraq sits upon a sea of oil, ongoing gasoline shortages plague Iraqis, who sometimes wait 2 days just to fill their cars. In a country where a long gas line once meant a one-car wait, Iraqis who are lucky enough to afford it now purchase black market petrol and hope that it is not watered down. Electricity remains in short supply. Most of Iraq, including the northern region, receives on average 3 hours of electricity per day amidst a nearly non-existent reconstruction effort. Even the better areas of Baghdad receive only 6 to 8 hours per day, forcing those who can afford them to use small generators to run fans and refrigerators in their homes. Of course, this is only for those who've been able to obtain the now rarefied gasoline. The security situation is, needless to say, horrendous. With over 100,000 Iraqis killed thus far, and the number of U.S. soldiers now past 2,000, the violence only continues to escalate. Since the new Iraqi so-called government was sworn in this past April, well over 3,700 Iraqis and over 550 U.S. soldiers have died in the violence. These numbers will only continue to escalate as the occupation grinds on. As the heavy-handed tactics of the U.S. military persist, the Iraqi resistance continues to grow in its numbers and lethality. As I mentioned before, potable water remains in short supply. Cholera, typhoid, and other waterborne diseases are rampant, even in parts of the capital city, as lack of reconstruction continues to plague Iraq's infrastructure. Raw sewage is common throughout not just Baghdad, but other cities throughout Iraq. With over 70% unemployment, a growing resistance, and an infrastructure in shambles, the future for Iraq remains bleak as long as the failed occupation persists. While the Bush administration continues to disregard calls for a timetable for withdrawal, Iraqis continue to suffer and die with little hope for their future. With each passing day, the catastrophe in Iraq resembles the U.S. debacle in Vietnam more and more. Dr. Wamid Omar Nathmi, a senior political scientist at Baghdad University, told me last winter during an interview, "It will take Iraqis something like a quarter of a century to rebuild their country, to heal their wounds, to reform their society, to bring about some sort of national reconciliation, democracy, and tolerance for each other. But that promise will not begin until the U.S. occupation of Iraq ends." A poll was released, which was commissioned by the British military, and the results came out 2 days ago. And according to that poll, 82% of Iraqis strongly opposed a continuing presence of foreign troops in their country. Less than 1% of the population feels foreign troops have helped improve the security situation, and 45% of Iraqis felt that attacks against U.S. troops were now justified. When I was at Turkey at the World Tribunal on Iraq, the culminating session this past June, they made several recommendations after hearing testimonies for 3 days from countless people, journalists, human rights workers, aid workers, and Iraqis themselves. And they came up with many recommendations at the end of the culminating session. And their top three recommendations, which I'll provide these to you tonight. One, a full, immediate, unconditional withdrawal of all occupation forces from Iraq. Two, full compensation paid to every Iraqi who has suffered the loss of a loved one or damage as the result of the invasion or occupation. And three, all reconstruction projects reopened for bidding, giving Iraqi companies preference. Now I want to talk a little bit about Fallujah in order to introduce this film that I'll show you. It was made by American and Iraqi filmmakers. And as a way to sort of highlight the media disparity regarding Fallujah, I want to give you a bit of background and contextualization for what led up to the November siege. Because a lot of this is information that's really not provided by most mainstream media outlets, which, for example, starting in Fallujah, and I think Fallujah is such an important situation to keep talking about because it's really been sort of the model of Bush foreign policy, sort of a model of this is what's going to happen to you if you resist U.S. foreign policy in your country. And that's what happened in Fallujah. And it couldn't have happened without the complicity of a lot of major broadcast networks, not just in America, but in other Western European countries as well. And just to give you an idea of this, in Fallujah, before the invasion took place, most people in that city considered themselves victims and opponents of Saddam Hussein, to the point where even during the invasion itself, there wasn't any fighting in Fallujah. The tribal leaders and the religious leaders of Fallujah banded together and appointed a very pro-U.S. Sheikh to work with the occupation authorities. And there wasn't any fighting in the city, but troubles began when about 3 months after the fall of Baghdad, so right towards the end of April of 2003, U.S. forces had occupied a secondary school in Iraq, in Fallujah. And people obviously weren't keen to this idea. The classes were coming up. And so the day before classes were to begin, a demonstration was held of about 400 to 500 people in front of that school. And when they were asked to disperse by troops, they didn't disperse. And the U.S. soldiers then shot into the crowd and killed 17 people. Hence, the resistance was born in Fallujah. So people began attacking the U.S. military. And the military, of course, responded with more patrols, more home raids, heavier-handed tactics, which, of course, generated more resistance inside the city, and so it went. By the time March rolled around in 2004, the military really couldn't run patrols through the city because they were being attacked so heavily and so quickly. So they were using security contractors, i.e. mercenaries, to go around in the city, which is what these Blackwater USA folks were doing. And people inside the city for months before what happened on March 31st, when the four of them were killed and the horrible things done to their bodies, people were telling stories that these contractors were going around because they don't have to operate under the military rules of engagement. And these contractors were going around and carrying out assassinations inside of Fallujah. And there were also reports of rapes and looting being done by these security contractors. So on March 31st, a small group of these contractors were going through Fallujah, and they were attacked by resistance fighters, and then the horrible things were done to their bodies. What wasn't reported in most mainstream outlets was that this action, what was done to these men, them being attacked and what was done to their bodies, it was staunchly denounced by all of the political and religious leaders of the city, all the tribal leaders, all of the imams and in the mosque speakers within Fallujah staunchly and immediately denounced what was done to the bodies of these men. And then after that, the military leaders in charge of Fallujah, the U.S. military commander, said, "This is obviously a huge setback, very bad thing to have to deal with, but we still feel that a total siege of the city would be a really bad idea. And instead, we want to keep trying to..." There were some small reconstruction projects they were engaged in around Fallujah. They were doing this to try to win the hearts and minds and win the trust of the people of the city. And the commander in charge of Fallujah himself said, we want to keep trying to do that. We know this is going to be a long haul, but sieging the city would basically be the worst case thing that we could do. But nevertheless, just like the invasion of Iraq, the order to launch a full-scale siege of the city came directly from the White House. So on April 4th, the first siege of the city began, and it was a very brutal siege. Many U.S. soldiers were killed. Many Iraqi civilians were killed. Fallujah General Hospital, after that siege, estimated that 734 people were killed in Fallujah and that 60% of them were civilians. But then it became clear to the military that they weren't going to be able to take the city without a full siege, which is what they did in November of 04. So they essentially cut a deal with the mayor of the city and some of the groups in the city to turn security over to the people of Fallujah, which is what they did. And so from May of 04 up until November, the city was unoccupied, and there were no military patrols rolling through the city at that time.
I think before I start taking any questions, how I've decided to end my presentations as of late is with this, and this is the reason why I've had you talk to this other person a couple of times already. We're in a situation now in this country where the Constitution is not being followed, nor is international law. Syria, there's been fighting on the Iraqi-Syrian border now for several weeks. And in fact, even last May, I reported that U.S. warplanes were flying into Syria. We have a situation in Iraq where there's 14 permanent U.S. military bases being constructed, 106 temporary bases. There's no plans for withdrawal. It's not about getting Iraqi forces trained up so that U.S. forces can leave. It's not about creating political stability there so that U.S. forces then leave. It's because this administration has no plans of leaving Iraq. If we passed 2,000 dead U.S. soldiers yesterday, we have at least 3 more years in Iraq. That's 2.5 years, so we can easily double that number. And so this is not going to stop, certainly not by methods that have been being used so far. So I want you to take a minute and think, what is the one thing that you've thought about doing but haven't done for whatever reason? And it's going to be a different thing for every person. Maybe it's going to be go to your first demonstration. Maybe it's going to be write letters to your senators or congressperson. Maybe it's going to be joining an affinity group so you can do direct action. Maybe it's going to be, I don't know what it's going to be for each person. For me, it was go to Iraq and try to report on what I saw there. But I think we're at a critical enough time in this country with the way things are going, with this administration, an unelected administration, and we saw how much they care for their people. In case anyone didn't get to see that by what's happening in Iraq, we saw that up close and personal with Katrina. And this is not going to change. And so I feel it's time for everyone to think about that one thing that up until this point you've either been unwilling to do or too afraid to do, and think about what that thing is for you right now, and turn to the person that you've been talking to already and commit to them to do that one next thing that you feel like you could do to make a difference and to try to change things, the situation at home or regarding the situation in Iraq. So do that right now, please, and then maybe we can all take some questions. Thanks. Okay, we'll go ahead and take a few questions before we close it out for the night. Any questions?
If you were part of this conversation, where are you going next? And then where do you find hope in the situation in Iraq, or do you?
Right now I'm doing a presentation tour for the next few weeks, and then I'm going to go back and I'm working on a book to get out what I've seen there, and then my goal is to have that done by the summer and then head back over to Iraq to continue the reporting. And the hope, I pretty much start to go crazy if I look at the big picture, because it is so dismal in Iraq right now with this referendum passing we already have, which is fraudulent and illegal by international law. But
we passed that up a long time ago. And now we have already the SUNY political leaders have come out and said, well, we're going to probably be boycotting December 15th, at least some of. So we have guaranteed violence continuing and big political instability. So it's looking bleaker and bleaker as it continues, of course, as it has. I think, you know, I just keep, I find the hope in seeing that the political climate here change. More and more people in this country are starting to really get what's going on. The one silver lining of Katrina is that ripped the facade off what this administration is doing and the effects of their policies abroad. You know, it connected the dots that, yeah, us people here are paying the price for what's happening in Iraq, not just people like this who are losing loved ones over there, but anyone, whether you're directly involved or not, is paying for it. And I think just to keep doing work that bring information to people so that anyone who doesn't have the full story can see it. Just keep doing this to get information out, because yeah, it's really bleak. And to go be over in a situation like Iraq and see the dead bodies and see the suffering on both sides and just see how horrible the situation is, and then to go from that back here, where, you know, for some folks their biggest concern is what movie to rent at Blockbuster, it's a little bit maddening. And I can relate well to the PTSD that he speaks about, because it happens to anyone that has much involvement at all with Iraq. That's what the situation generates. It's crazy making. And I think, you know, I'm able to sleep better at night trying to do work like testifying at the World Tribunal and get this stuff on record so that hopefully the picture of the Three Stooges / three war criminals, justice will be served one day. Yes, sir.
What I'm fearing is that they're going to use the judiciary. This question didn't come up during the Supreme Court hearings. What's your position on the detainee policies and the torture? And I think that's one thing that definitely plays into why there's so many cases of post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd just like to say the first thing I'm going to do is try to work against recruitment and then bring people an alternative vision in towns where the poverty draft is really high. And that's in a lot of places. And to Dar Jamal, I'd just like to thank you. Your coverage of what happened in Fallujah has been so important to me understanding what's happened so far. I'd just like to ask, maybe it's so, like, the two sides are so different. Like, I watched the History Channel and they showed the Battle of Fallujah as if it was a video game. With little computer graphics of things going over walls, of things exploding, not showing any of the real impact. And then you look at that and then you go against the real picture of what happened. How do you start to get across to people? How do you start to break that divide without kind of seeming extreme, like, well, this is happening, all this is happening? It's hard to convey. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Well, it's a grassroots thing. It's doing like what we're doing right here. It's the three of us going around the way we do, talking to people just like this, community radio, community TV, and that film that I showed, it is for sale. There's small flyers for it. It's called Caught in the Crossfire, up on that table. And buy that and have a screening. And a screening means even with like your neighbor or one other person. But in that way, one person at a time getting the information out. And I think it's all of this starting to accumulate now, which we're seeing, is why now at least 60% of Americans think Iraq was a bad idea and are opposed to it and want us to get out. And that will continue to increase as time goes on. I think we are seeing this change happening. And, you know, as it's been said before, the revolution will not be televised. Things are changing, and it certainly won't be televised by corporate media. So things are changing, but, you know, we will keep doing what we do. And I think it's a grassroots person-to-person thing, and it starts right here. Like, you have, I believe it's a congressperson, his name's McDermott, I think, here, is that right, that has introduced legislation to try to cut off funding for the war and bring the National Guard of this state home and things like this. And I think, you know, supporting people like that, and if you have a congressperson that's pro-war, well, 2006, start working to do whatever the hell you can to get them out, because anyone in their right mind is not going to support this ongoing criminal activity. So anyway, I'm probably going off on a bit of a tangent there. I'll pass the mic.
I just want to ask, Star, if you could explain in a way that help us to explain to other people why that referendum was illegal. I mean, I listened to John Kerry today come out with a statement that, you know, we had to start bringing the troops home, but we couldn't do it until their political situation was all worked out. As we could see already with the referendum that was happening, the situation was improving. And I was listening to this BS and getting very frustrated. But, you know, I'd like to be able to put it all together. Tell us how that was illegal and what's going on with that.
Well, people like Kerry and a lot of the other powerful Democrats like him are basically Republicans with a smile. We don't have an opposition. We don't have an opposition party. The Democrats are not an opposition party. That said, the situation with the referendum, first of all, we have to go all the way back to the fact that the entire invasion was a violation of international law. It was against the Constitution for Congress to just give their check of the ability of the president to wage war, just write a blank check, basically, to the president. Those are the two main things, just kind of going through it rather quickly. And then for an occupying power to change the laws of the country it occupies is a violation of international law. It's even a violation of the U.S. Army Act. And so the fact that these elections took place, we have to go back to the appointment of the Iraqi Governing Council, then the interim government that took over on the June 28th, 04 transfer of sovereignty. Each one of these, step by step, has been another violation of international law. All of this, the fact that any of this has taken place, all of the changes of Iraq's economic laws under the 100 Bremer orders, which were signed over to Yadlawi on June 28th, which then are now like official legitimate Iraq law, all of this is violations of international law. So the fact that this referendum vote even took place is a violation of international law. The fact that the December 15th vote will take place is a violation of international law. And then we won't even get into the minor instances of things like illegal attacks on cities and collective punishments and things like this. And we see now recently there is a lot of flak hitting the fan regarding torture. And again, while it's happening on the ground, all roads point to the top. You know, at the very least, the stooge Rumsfeld is responsible, and probably even above him as well. So it's just the stuff's starting to roll uphill for a change, and I think that's what who is responsible for all of this directly. It's very clear. We just had one of the army generals, I can't remember her name, but she's been speaking out recently, Karpinski, basically saying, look, these were our orders. They're posted on the walls in Abu Ghraib. It's coming from the top, and that's who's directly responsible. But yeah, that's why the referendum is illegal. There's been rampant fraud up and down the country, very well documented by a lot of the political groups in Iraq, which, of course, aren't being given a voice by the corporate media. I mean, there's no way that Nineveh province, which was the last province that was kind of hanging up the vote as that got counted, it's a very primarily Sunni province. They have the majority, and there's many, many evidence much evidence of ballot boxes full of no votes essentially just being discarded and taken away and taken into U.S. bases, and the count happened there, just like it happened after the January 30 election.
Gentleman right here.
Mr. Radar, how often do you encounter audiences where the members of it aren't entirely in favor of what you say, or they're not aware of the information, and what is the reaction from those people?
Well, typically the question is like how often do I encounter audiences where everyone's basically on the same page and relatively well informed and such, and it's pretty much the majority of the time now. I do have some people I've had people, audience members that disagree, but I think, when simply giving the facts and let them speak for themselves, I mean, it's gone pretty well for me. I really haven't run into any flack or anything like that. I've definitely had bigger audiences where, most people don't know the majority of the folks in the room. And consistently what I find, though, is it's pretty clear that And I find the same when I ask, you know, these folks that go around and talk, and some of my friends in Iraq Veterans Against the War, and some of the other folks with Gold Star families that are going around talking, that consistently, everyone that I talk to and what I've seen is that the audiences keep getting bigger and bigger and more fired up. People have really had enough. And again, you're not going to see this if you watch the mainstream media that always downgrades the numbers of the people showing up in D.C. at the marches and things like this, that, you know, across the country, people have had enough and people are ready for change. And I think, you know, it's now or never time, really, at this point, to, you know, with the midterms coming up and then, of course, what's going to happen in 08. Because if massive change doesn't start happening now, for example, regarding doing away with electronic voting machines and things like this, then, you know, it's really a critical time in this country, and these people aren't going to stop. How about way up there in the back?
My name's Charles. I'm also from the Anti-War Coalition here. And I think what was brought up about Kerry saying that his statement about bringing troops out, it's just like what we heard in the 60s, where people were for war now and for peace later. We really need to be unapologetic and unambiguous about the slogan "troops out now." And I was wondering, Dar, if you could talk about some of like the daily catastrophes that are occurring in Iraq due to the troops there, and what kind of responses we can make once we get the troops out to help them rebuild their country, because it is our responsibility, but we should be thinking in terms of reparations, not security.
Well, there is this big debate, and certainly people like Kerry and Hillary Clinton have taken it up that, well, we, you know, yes, it's wrong and it's a mistake and we need to pull out, but we have to finish the job or we have to help them reconstruct. And personally, I think that's very racist and imperialistic, because Iraq, this is essentially where civilization began. You know, they know this is where law began. They know very well how to sort out their own problems, and they managed to reconstruct their country after the 91 Gulf War in a matter of months, even under the sanctions. So given the opportunity, they can. The thing is they're not being given the opportunity. Far less than 2% of all the contracts, reconstruction contracts awarded, have gone to Iraqi concerns. And then the companies operating in Iraq, they won't hire Iraqis. They're bringing in third country nationals instead, because they can pay, it's slave labor. They can pay them next to nothing and have them do the work and increase their profit margin. So that's one of the recommendations of the World Tribunal, is an immediate unconditional withdrawal. All reconstruction contracts immediately reopen for bidding, giving Iraqi concerns top priority, and let them rebuild their own country. That immediately is going to seriously cut into the 70% unemployment rate, which, in my opinion, is one of the big engines fueling the resistance, is people are sometimes even doing the resistance for economic reasons. If they can get paid $500 to plant an IED in order to feed their family, well, that's what they're going to do, because that's how desperate the situation is. Recently, the director for the Iraqi Red Crescent was asked, what do you need the most right now? And he said, we need water filters and we need freezers for cadavers, because they can't keep up, because the morgues in Baghdad are just overflowing on a daily basis, and they don't even know where all the bodies are coming from or who they are. And that's how horrible the situation is. And the number also of U.S. soldiers, 2,000, it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more than that. And the wounded is at least 10 times that. And when we say wounded, we mean permanently disabled for the rest of their life. And as far as the count, that 2,000, that doesn't include a lot of soldiers that are dying after they're removed from Iraq. That's not including suicides. That's not including the fact that when soldiers come back here, even according to a survey conducted by the Army Surgeon General, that this came out on July 29th, that 30% of all the troops coming home within 3 to 4 months are developing serious mental problems. And that's according to an Army survey. According to another Army survey, of all the units in Iraq, 56% reported either low or very low morale. And that's according to, again, to an Army survey. So we know that the reality is probably at least a bit worse than that. So this is what's happening. It's a daily catastrophe for U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians alike. So the whole argument of, well, we have to stay there to help, well, that's never been the intention. These corporations that have these contracts in Iraq, like Bechtel and Cheney's company Halliburton, their intention has never been to help Iraqis and never been to allow them to rebuild their own country. Their intention is to profit. And if you look at the profit margins of the oil companies and Bechtel and Halliburton, every quarter since the invasion of Iraq, they've been posting record profits.
In the light of the film that you showed, which is such a profound experience of suffering and desecration of people, the people in Iraq who are called the insurgency, who conduct the suicide bombings, I'm going to ask you for a heart and gut answer on this, not a political analysis. Mostly they're targeting fellow Iraqis, their neighbors. Why? Why do they want to increase the suffering of their own people?
They're not targeting Iraqis. Actually, they're, first of all, talking about the Iraqi resistance, there's at least 40 different groups operating in Iraq. And according, and even according to the military, 10% of them maximum are from outside of the country. But there's definitely foreign terrorist groups operating in Iraq. And there have actually been documented, even by the U.S. military, instances of resistance groups fighting against terrorist groups. They call that red-on-red fire. And it's been documented by the military on several instances. They don't want these people there. They don't like the fact that these people are targeting innocent Iraqis, like in mosque bombings and things like this. But we also have covert operations going on, like what happened recently in Basra with two British SAS guys undercover, caught by Iraqi police in a carload, you know, wearing dishdasha, wearing keffiyehs and a mustache, and with a carload of explosives and detonation devices. So we have accused them of intentionally setting bombs to generate sectarian conflict. So we have that going on as well. Some of it too is just crime. The criminal element can't be underestimated in Iraq, so some of it's that as well. But again, a lot of that is the media, that we don't have just radical resistance groups running around killing as many Iraqis as they can. That's really not what's going on, because the reality is that, according again to the Lancet report, 85% of all violent deaths in Iraq are being generated by occupation forces, not by the suicide car bombings. And the Iraqi Ministry of Health says that 2/3 of all the violent deaths in Iraq are generated by the occupation forces, not by, you know, it's mostly because of airplanes dropping 2,000-pound bombs in cities. That I don't know if any of you guys watched that video of that cement truck bomb that went off by the Palestine Hotel, how big that was. Well, that's what it looks like when a U.S. warplane drops a 2,000-pound bomb in the middle of Fallujah. And that's why so many civilians are being killed. But it's a horrific situation, and that definitely is happening, that there are resistance attacks that are, you know, car bombs taking out civilians and that sort of thing. And it's just like when warplanes drop bombs. It's a horrific situation. And again, it's you know, with the political instability generated by the occupation forces and such, it's just really the only way to start the end is not that pulling out completely and immediately is going to be the panacea that fixes everything. Certainly there's going to be more instability and more fighting, but immediately it's going to remove the biggest generator of casualties and creative instability. Quick question. Thanks for coming, everyone.